Hello and welcome to the Pirate Party Australia webcast, dedicated to the discussion of freedom of information and culture, government transparency and civil liberties in the internet age. I'm Sam Kearns, and this is episode number 3 for Monday, the 14th of May, 2012. It's been a busy week for pirate politics, both locally and around the world, so in this episode I'm going to put on my newsreader's hat and cover some recent events. On Friday the 11th of May, at the latest round of the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations in Texas, 24 rogue delegates crashed the welcoming gala event. A well-dressed activist with an official-looking award plaque took to the podium right after the welcoming speech of US Trade Ambassador Ron Kirk and announced that the US trade negotiators had won the 2012 Corporate Power Tool Award. Meanwhile, other activists exchanged hundreds of rolls of toilet paper throughout the conference venue with printed rolls containing an anti-TPP message and also projected a message on the venue's facade. Interestingly, I can't find clear information about who actually organised this protest. It was Yes Lab who made the press release about the action, but they are an organisation who assists others in organising effective activism events, and it is unclear if their involvement was as consultants or if this was entirely their own action. Regardless, I applaud their determination to ensure that the latest round of TPPA talks does not go by unnoticed. You can read the full press release and see a video that includes the fake award ceremony at their website at yeslab.org. Also on May 11th, we had news from the Sydney Morning Herald that the government has announced plans for a major expansion of powers for Australian intelligence agencies. The expanded powers include extending search warrants from 90 days to 6 months, creating a single warrant to cover all forms of communication, allowing the Attorney General to make variations to warrants, and making it easier to renew warrants. More worryingly, the government is also making another push to put in place a data retention scheme, forcing telecommunication providers to retain logs of their customers' activities for up to 2 years. Pirate Party Australia hit back with a press release slamming the super warrants proposal as an affront to judicial principles and an erosion of the Western ideals of civil rights and freedom. A major hallmark of an electronic police state is one in which authorities universally and silently gather information for use against its citizens, regardless of whether they are currently suspected of a crime or not, and this is exactly what is being proposed here. Remember that in the 21st century, communications are not just letters and phone calls, but also security cameras, internet banking, online shopping, even your physical location 24/7, presuming you keep your mobile phone with you at all times, which most people do. Renee LeMay at Delimiter.com.au reports that both the Australian federal government and the opposition party have teamed up to block the motion put by Green Senator Scott Ludlam, which would have forced the Attorney General's department to disclose the details of secret piracy meetings. The meetings are being held by the Attorney General's department with internet service providers and representatives of the film, television, and music industries to discuss a solution to the problem of online copyright infringement. 4 such meetings have been held so far, and the total lack of transparency, along with the refusal to allow consumer groups to be involved, has only fueled speculation that the public interest is not being represented at these meetings. Crossing to Germany now, and on May 10th, just days before a regional election, a new pro-copyright group has been launched in reaction to the recent success of the German Pirate Party in other regions. Formed as a coalition of hundreds of authors, musicians and artists with several high-profile German celebrities, the group is calling itself We Are the Creators and claims the concept of copyright is a historical achievement. Fortunately, many of their arguments are old and have long been soundly rebutted by the pirate movement. However, that should not be taken as a reason to dismiss their importance. The voice of creators will automatically be placed on higher moral ground by the general public when it comes to debates on copyright reform, regardless of whether their arguments are morally superior or not. On May 7th, the Joint Standing Committee on Treaties held a public hearing at Australian Parliament House, and part of their business of the day was the discussion of the proposed Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA as it is more widely known. Dr. Luigi Palombi, an expert on biotech patents in Australia, the EU and the USA, gave an excellent submission slamming ACTA and the patent system in general and did a great job of representing the pirate case, even though he has no affiliation with us that I'm aware of. Green Senator Scott Ludlam was also present and really put the hard questions to the committee regarding the pitfalls of ACTA, pointing out, among other things, that it will restrict Australia's ability to make future changes to copyright enforcement law, and also demonstrating that the ACTA committee did not have any estimates of the actual economic impact of counterfeit goods with which to evaluate the trade-offs associated with signing the treaty. A full transcript of the hearing is available at the Parliament House website and will be linked from the show notes. Dr. Palombi's speech in particular is good reading. And finally, some slightly older but still important news is that on April 24th, Christian Engstrom and Rick Falkfinger released a book titled The Case for Copyright Reform, which succinctly lays out the reasoning behind the international pirate movement's demands for copyright reform. I think this book is an excellent primer to hand to anyone who is unfamiliar with pirate politics. It lays out the most important points very clearly at the start of the book, goes into more detail on specific aspects as you get further in, and then finishes with detailed scientific data for dedicated readers. I think every pirate should have a small stack of these to hand out to anyone who is curious about our stance on copyright. The book is available for free download from the book's website at copyrightreform.eu and can also be purchased in hard copy at the very reasonable price of $7.66 US plus shipping. And that wraps up the news for this episode. Links to all of the stories can be found in the blog entry for this show on pirateparty.org.au. For the second half of the show, we have the third installment of Rick Folkfinger's History of Copyright. When we last left off, it was 1886 and the Berne Convention had been signed, creating an international agreement for countries to respect each other's copyright, and also creating the BIRPI, now known as the WIPO, to act as watchdog. During most of the 20th century, a battle of prominence raged between performing musicians and the record industry. For most of the century, musicians were regarded as the important party in law and in common sense. However, the record industry would rather see music corporatized. Active intervention by the self-declared fascist regime in Italy tipped the scales in this direction. Copyright in the 20th century was not characterized by books, but by music. The 1930s saw two major developments that affected musicians: the Great Depression, which caused many musicians to lose their jobs, and movies with sound, which caused most of the rest of the musicians to lose their jobs. In this environment, two initiatives were taken in parallel. Musicians' unions tried to guarantee income and sustenance to the people who were now jobless, made redundant, as we say today, in executive speak. Unions all over the West were concerned about the spread of mechanized music, any music that isn't performed live and therefore didn't need performing musicians. They wanted some power over the speaker technology, and the question was raised through the International Labour Organization, a predecessor to the UN agency with the same name. At the same time, the recording industry tried to exert the exact same power over speakers, radio, and musicians. However, the entire political and business world at that time regarded them as a service contractor to the musicians. They could go about running their business if they were service-minded enough, or go bankrupt trying, and weren't worth diddly squat more than that to anyone. Anyone with just one exception. Fascist Italy. This word fascist is loaded with emotion today. Italy's regime at this time were self-declared fascists. I'm using the word to describe them exactly as they described themselves. In 1933, The phonographic industry was invited to Rome by Confederazione Generale Fascista dell'Industria Italiana and under the protection of SAIM. At this conference, held on November 10 to 14, an international federation of the phonographic industry was formed. It would later be more known under its acronym IFPI. It was agreed that IFPI would try to work within the Berne Convention to establish producers' rights, similar to those of the musicians and artists, which were always sold to publishers. IFPI continued to meet in countries which welcomed their corporatist agenda, so they met in Italy the next year too, in Stresa. 1935 and onwards proved a bit turbulent for the world at large, but Italy still enacted corporatist rights of the record industry in 1937. Negotiations for a copyright-like monopoly, attached to Berne and therefore international, were still too tempting for the record industry to resist, so after the war, IFPI reconvened in para-fascist Portugal in 1950. Italy wasn't suitable anymore, and the conference readied a draft text that would give them copyright-identical monopolies, so-called neighbouring rights, for producing and printing creative works such as music. This monopoly would be practically identical to the commercial copyright monopoly for fixations of a creative work. The neighbouring rights were ratified by BIRPI, today WIPO, in 1961 in the so-called Rome Convention, giving the record industry copyright-identical monopolies. At the same time, ILO's attempt to give musicians similar rights had flopped, waned, and failed. Since 1961, the record industry has feverishly defended copyright, despite the fact that it doesn't enjoy any copyright monopoly, only the copyright-identical monopoly known as neighbouring rights. One needs to remember two things at this point. First, the record industry is confusing all these monopolies on purpose. It keeps defending its copyright, which it doesn't have, and talks nostalgically about how this copyright monopoly was created in great wisdom during the dawn of the Enlightenment, insert sunset and kittens here, referring to the Statute of Anne in 1709, which wasn't the first copyright anyway. In reality, the neighbouring rights monopolies were created in fascist countries, literally, in a sunder-militarised recent Europe as late as 1961. These monopolies have been controversial and questioned from day one in 1961 and were certainly not the product of any Enlightenment wisdom. Second, we were but a hair's breadth from still regarding the record labels as service bureaus for musicians, had ILO not failed, instead of the chokehold on musicians that they have been for the past decades. This would have been the case if it had not been for two intervening fascist governments, fascist in the literal sense of the word, supporting the record industry in corporatizing society and becoming the copyright industry. Siege of the middlemen. Throughout the 20th century, people involved with the copyright monopoly as middlemen rather than artists fought tooth and nail against every new development of technology and culture alike. The current claims against people sharing on the net should be seen in the light of this history. Earlier, we looked at how the record industry middlemen did a successful regulatory capture in putting themselves in the middle of the economy. As we learned from history, this has been the norm with the middlemen's behaviour rather than the exception, but the last century has really seen this accelerate. It started around 1905 when the self-playing piano was becoming popular. Sellers of note sheet music proclaimed that this would be the end of artistry if they couldn't make a living off of being middlemen between composers and the public, so they called for a ban on the player piano. In the 1920s, as broadcast radio started appearing, another copyright industry was demanding its ban because it cut into profits. This time it was the business of pay telephone numbers that played music over the phone. If people can listen to music for free with this radio thing, artists will starve. This argument was reused through most of the century with the word radio replaced by the most recent technology. In the 1930s, silent movies were phased out by movies with audio tracks. Every theatre had previously employed an orchestra that played music to accompany the silent movies, and now these were out of a job. It is quite conceivable that this is the single worst technical development for professional performers. The unions demanded guaranteed jobs for these performers in varying propositions. In the 1960s, the copyright industry was fretting over people taping music off of radio and tried to have the practice banned. The debate died off about the same time it was pointed out that this ban was technically impossible with anything less than installing cameras in people's living rooms. The 1970s saw the advent of the cassette tape, which is when the copyright industry really went all out in proclaiming their entitlement. Ads saying, "Home taping is killing music," were everywhere. One band responded by subtly changing the message by changing "music" to "music industry" and "we left this side of their tape blank so you can help." It saw many other parodies too. Regardless, the copyright industry were acting very seriously on the message. The 1970s also saw another significant shift where DJs started taking the place of live dance music. Musicians' unions and the copyright industry went ballistic over this and suggested a disco fee that would be charged at locations playing disco recorded music, to be collected by private organizations under governmental mandate and redistributed to live bands. This produces hearty laughter today, but that laughter stops sharp with the realization that the disco fee was actually introduced and still exists. The 1980s is a special chapter with the advent of video recording. The copyright industry's famous quote when testifying before the US Congress, where the film lobby's highest representative said that "the VCR is to the American film producer and the American public as the Boston Strangler is to the woman home alone," is the stuff of legend today. Still, it bears reminding that the Betamax case went all the way to the Supreme Court and that the VCR was as near as could be to being killed by the copyright industry. The Betamax team won the case by 5-4 in votes at the United States Supreme Court. Also in the late 1980s, we saw the complete flop of the digital audio tape, DAT. A lot of this can be ascribed to the fact that the copyright industry had been allowed to put its politics into the design. The cassette, although technically superior to the analog compact cassette, was so deliberately unusable for copying music that people rejected it flat outright. This is an example of a technology that the copyright industry succeeded in killing, even though I doubt it was intentional. They just got their wishes as to how it would work to not disrupt the status quo. In 1994, the Fraunhofer Institute published a prototype implementation of its digital coding technique that would revolutionize digital audio. It allowed CD-quality audio to take one-tenth of the disk space, which was very valuable in this time, when a typical hard drive would be just a couple of gigabytes. Technically, known as MPEG-1 Audio Layer 3, it was quickly shortened to MP3 in everyday speak. The copyright industry screamed again, calling it a technology that can only be used for criminal activity. The first successful MP3 player, the Diamond Rio, saw the light in 1998. It had 32 megabytes of memory. Despite good sales, the copyright industry sued its maker, Diamond Multimedia, into oblivion. While the lawsuit was eventually struck down, the company did not recover from the burden of defending. The monopoly middlemen tried aggressively to have MP3 players banned, just like every previous piece of new technology. The century ended with the copyright middlemen pushing through a new law in the United States called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. For the first time, the copyright industry managed to introduce intermediary liability, as in making people liable in a court of law for merely carrying a signal which is broadcast by somebody else, just like if you put up a public wall and would become responsible for posters that other people put up on it. Not sane anywhere. But this isn't about sanity. It is about regulatory captures and enshrining the continued profit of monopolists into books of law. With just 10 years of history left to tell, we'll leave the history of copyright on a cliffhanger this week, with the final installment to come on the next show. Sorry this show is a bit short this week, but it took me longer than I expected to assemble those news items, and as I'm recording this, it's actually 10 to 2 a.m. on a Monday morning, and I should have been in bed hours ago. Our quote this week comes from Bruce Schneier, who is one of my favourite experts on the juxtaposition of security and civil liberties. "It is poor civic hygiene to install technologies that could someday facilitate a police state." The Pirate Party Australia webcast, including all music, is written, recorded and produced by Sam Kearns for Pirate Party Australia and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 unported license. Thanks for listening.